It's a pleasure to welcome Shuli back. It's really always a pleasure and an honor to have her teach. Of course, unfortunately, her live work is not so many tourists in Israel. We were there last week. The airports are empty. What can we say? Please God, we should be able to all go and keep Shuli and all the other tour guides busy in Israel. But it's really a pleasure to have you online, and I want to thank you. And we're looking forward to this series, Realia, what life was like, the average person, you know, in the time of the Mishnah, the Tanaim, and the Morim. Do I have to say anything else, oh, Shuli, or you're ready to begin?
I'm ready to begin.
Okay,
I will say that this week, I live in Gush Etzion in Alon Shvut, and this week we had the Yemei Eiyun B'Tanach here in Alon Shvut, packed with people. So, you know, people are coming out, they're doing things. I did a tiyul for them yesterday. I had almost 50 people. So they might not be flying in, but there definitely are a lot of people here, and they're doing things. So, Be'ezrat Hashem.
Thank you.
We'll have more people.
I was there last week. I was amazed in Jerusalem. The people are out for us. You, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know.
But everybody's out and about, because that is what we do. All right. Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me back here.
But there were over 3,000 people at the Tzohar conference yesterday as well.
Yeah, also, there's so much stuff going on. It's amazing. It's amazing what's going on. Okay. I am going to start here. Is this on the bottom of my screen? Okay. Beseder. So the genesis of this new course, actually comes from, it comes from the fact that I've been learning Daf Yomi for, I guess it's about, I don't know how far in the new cycle are we. I guess it's about 11 years now. I'm in my second round. And towards the beginning of this cycle, meaning 4 years ago, Rabbanit Michelle Farber, who runs Hadran, which is an unbelievable resource, and she's an unbelievable Torah teacher, Gemara teacher, we know each other, and she asked me if I thought it would be, you know, a good idea to write a weekly article about the realia of the Talmud. And I agreed. And it's always been challenging. Some weeks there's really very, very little to work with. Some weeks there's a ton. But there's a lot that I've really gained from this. And that's what I want to try to give over to you. I will emphasize that what we're going to do here in the next five, maybe six sessions is a drop in the sea of the Talmud, right? We talk about the Talmud as a sea, Yama Talmud. This is a tiny drop, but hopefully it will be a drop that will help people who learn Gemara, people who are interested in Eretz Yisrael, and people who are just, you know, at the intersection of all those different things, to gain an appreciation of this time and place. And here's what we're going to do. So we're going to try to understand the context of the Mishnah and the Gemara. Where did things happen? Who were the ruling powers? What are the historical backgrounds to the story? As anyone who's learned Gemara knows, the Gemara is a little bit of everything, right? We've got halachot, of course, but we've got all kinds of nice stories, biographies, medical advice, everything is thrown in. But it's not a history book, right? Whatever history we get is sort of by the way, right? Let's just talk about it by the way. So we're going to try to draw out some of the historical background. We're going to try to get a feeling for everyday life. And we're also going to try to do something which is very hard, and I don't promise to do it all that well, because it's still something that is very much a work in progress for scholars who are much, much greater than I am. And that's to kind of separate the layers, right? We talk about Mishnah and Gemara. We sort of think of it as monolithic. It is in no way monolithic. We have centuries upon centuries from the earliest Mishnayot to the redacting of the Babylonian Talmud. And we also have many, many different places. Okay. So we're going to talk about Eretz Yisrael today. Next week, we're going to talk about the diaspora, largely Babylonia, but not only. Those are very, very different worlds. And when the Babylonian Talmud talks about Eretz Yisrael, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't, right? And we're going to try to look at that also. So there's a lot going on, and we'll try to separate out some of them and see some of the different personalities, all different kinds of things. Okay, who are some of our helpers in this attempt? Okay, one of the main families in modern scholarship, modern Torah scholarship, not so much academic, are the Safrai family, Shmuel Safrai from Kfutzat Yavne, and his children, Ze'ev Safrai and Chana Safrai, Alea Shalom. They created what's called Mishnat Eretz Yisrael, the Mishnah of the Land of Israel, which is really about this, right? Helping us to understand where things happen, what's the context, what's the realia. So they're definitely going to be part of the story. Of course, Professor Yehuda Felix, who was one of the great botanists and wrote books about the botany of the Mishnah and the Gemara, botany and also flora and fauna. Ben-Sion Segal, who's a little bit lesser known, but wrote geography of the Mishnah, and many others as we go along. Okay, today we're going to focus on Eretz Yisrael, where everything began. We're also going to do a little bit of a timeline that we might come back to as we go along in this course, unless you all memorize it. Oh, Rabbi Kalman, did we put the sources in the chat? Let's do that for people who want to see them, not just on the Zoom, right? And we're going to go through some of the sections of Eretz Yisrael, like the regions. And then at the end, the last third or so, we're going to zoom in on specific places. All right, let's go. If our thing goes. Okay, so let's just take a look. This is a, you know, it's obviously not a super detailed map, but it's certainly a helpful enough map for us to understand some of the regions of the country that we're going to be talking about. This week, like I said, we're going to focus on Eretz Yisrael. And in this case, we're going to talk about Eretz Yisrael west of the Jordan River, meaning Transjordan, the other side we're going to talk about. And it is in some ways considered the land of Israel, but we're going to save it for next week because we have more than enough going on. Okay, so let's just take a look. Obviously, we have Judea, the heartland of the land of Israel, right, where Jerusalem is, Hebron, Beit Lechem, et cetera, et cetera. A place that is super important when the Beit HaMikdash is standing. The sources are in the chat. We're going to get to them soon. Remains important after the Korban, but after the Bar Kokhba revolt, the center of Jewish life really mostly leaves Judea. We're going to talk about an interesting exception and moves to the north. But Judea is definitely Judea or Yehuda, as it's termed in the Mishnah and the Gemara. That's one very significant section. The southern portion of Yehuda, here it says Idumea, where the Edumim live. But by the time we get to the Mishnah, the Hashmonaim have conquered this area. It's a Jewish area. And we're going to talk about Daroma, the place in the south. So just keep that in your head in the map. We're going to come back to it. Okay. The other major Jewish center that we have is the Galil, the Galilee. Okay. The Galilee up here above the Jezreel Valley. We'll come back to a more detailed map of the Galilee, but the Galilee, obviously, very, very important part of Jewish life, as is the Golan, right? The Golan, what's called here Golanitis, which is on the other side of the Jordan, but today we're going to include it. We don't have a lot of sources in Chazal about the Golan, but we do have a lot of archaeology, right? And obviously, we're going to be using archaeology as we talk today. In between these two major Jewish centers, we have Samaria or Shomron, which is a center not of Jews, but of the Shomronim, of what are called the Kutim by the rabbis. We'll get to them. They are sometimes considered Jews, sometimes not considered Jews, often hostile to Jews, and they're definitely a separate region in and of themselves. We also have the coast, which is not really like delineated here, but important to know because the coast, as opposed to the center of the country and the mountains, the coast is often very pagan and then Christian. Jews are living there. Okay, today, if we get to it, we're going to try to get to Caesarea and Ashkelon. Jews are living there, but they are not the majority. Okay. The other side of the Jordan, just to point it out for a minute, okay, we have over here in the middle what's called the Decapolis, an alliance of 10 Roman cities, one of them on the western side of the Jordan, that's Beit She'an. Okay, we'll look at that a little bit today, but the other 9 all on the eastern side of the Jordan. So that's very, very Greek, starts out as a Greek polis, and the Roman polis eventually becomes important Christian cities, but not Jewish. But there is a Jewish area on the eastern side of the Jordan, or the left bank of the Jordan, as Zev Jabotinsky says it. And that's what's called Perea over here. Okay, so this kind of southern narrow section, also something to keep in mind. Okay, so we have different regions. We will be coming back to them as we go along. Is my moving not working? Okay. Yes, there's a lot of timeline here. Don't freak out. Okay. We're just going to get a quick look at it. We don't want to memorize it. We'll try to be coming back to things. And like I said, we're really going to be all over the timeline. But basically, and this is borrowed from the Steinsaltz introduction to the Gemara, and you have it in your source sheets if you want to take a look at it. We have the generations of first the Zugot, right, the pairs, which ends with Hillel and Shammai. And then starting over here, Gamliel HaZaken. And the numbers refer to the generations of the Tanaim, right? And we have the generations, the 6 generations. Obviously, there are many, many more people in each generation. He picked out the most important or 2 most important people in each generation, just to give you kind of lisaberatos. And so we have like a little bit of an idea. Okay, so we've got our 6 generations of Tanaim, roughly corresponding what's happening in the land of Israel. Okay, the end of the Herodian period. And then 2nd generation to the 3rd generation, the 2nd temple is destroyed. Yavne rebuilding with the 3rd, 4th generation. We have the Bar Kokhba revolt and rebuilding. By the way, not everybody agrees with this numbering, but it's useful enough for now. Okay. And finally, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the redaction, not the writing down, but the redaction, the editing, the putting together of the Mishnah, okay? And to understand the rulers here, all of this is dealing only with what's going on in Eretz Yisrael, because the Tanaim are only in Eretz Yisrael, okay? But when we move to the Amoraim, okay, then we already are in our split screen, of Eretz Yisrael and Babylonia. Right? Babylonia becomes important. There's always been a Jewish community there since the first temple has been destroyed, but it becomes important with the yeshivot of Rav and Shmuel. Okay, we have a transitional generation in Eretz Yisrael between the Tanaim and the Amoraim. Okay, and then we have our however many, right, in Eretz Yisrael, 5 generations of Tanaim, of Amoraim, excuse me, in Babylonia. It goes on much longer. Things are much easier. Life is better in Babylonia at that point than in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? And important things to notice, what's happening in the world. Okay, we're going to talk about the rulers in Babylonia next time and how they are very, very different from the Romans. So don't worry about that too much. 4th century Christianity becomes an officially recognized religion in the Roman Empire. That's going to have a huge impact on the Jews. And we are going to see it here and there, okay, in the Gemara. The Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is really should be called the Tveria Talmud because it's completed in Tveria. Jerusalem has no Jews living in it at this point. Okay. By the end of the 4th century, and then 100 years later, the Babylonian Talmud is finished. Okay, again, don't worry if it doesn't all stick in your head, but it's useful to have like a big picture. Somebody asked me, I just glanced in the chat, so I'll just look for a second, why 2 Caesareas? Where do you see 2 Caesareas? Here's one. Oh, here. Yeah, well, Caesarea Caesarea really just is named after the Caesar, right? So there's a few Caesareas because, you know, we always want to say good things about the Caesar. But can we think of an American or Canadian equivalent? I don't know. King's Road, King's Highway, King's, right? That's what this is. Right? So you have Caesarea, which is really called Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea. This is Caesarea Philippi. I think there's more than that, but that's what's on this map. Okay. Moving along. And if we're already talking about Caesars, let's talk about Romans, right? All roads lead to Rome. In Eretz Yisrael, all roads lead to Aelia Capitolina, which is what the Romans call Jerusalem. Okay. the Roman road system in the land of Israel, we have about 1,500 kilometers, right? 1,000 Roman miles. A Roman mile is between a kilometer and hour miles. So we have about 1,000 Roman miles of road in the land of Israel. They are built beginning with the first revolt in the first century of the Common Era, and then they kind of really pick up speed after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Why? Because when you think of roads, don't think of people going on a nice road trip. Why are the Romans building roads? They're building roads to move their soldiers from place to place. So after the Bar Kokhba revolt, they say, enough, we've had enough with these people, and we're going to have a very complete road network throughout the land of Israel so we can get where we need to go when we need to go there. Okay, we still have remains of this road system in various places. This is a very nice section that's preserved not far from Tzur Hadassah and Beitar, right on the outskirts of Jerusalem. And we have it in other places as well. Often we find it when we're making new road construction in the land of Israel, in the state of Israel, because if the Romans thought it was a good place to make a road, it's probably still a good place to make a road, right? And so we often will come across pieces of the Roman road, and we often are making our roads more or less where the Roman roads were. The other things we're finding in various places around the country are what you see here on the right, and that's milestones. Okay? A milestone is not your 50th birthday. A milestone is literally a column that says on it a number of things. It's usually written in Latin and in Greek. In Greek, which is the useful language, which is the language that everybody speaks or knows or at least is somewhat familiar with, it tells you X number of Roman miles to the center of the nearest big city. Right. So it might say to Aelia Capitolina, it might say to Caesarea, it might say to Beit Shean, right? But then you all have a whole section before that, the Latin section, which tells you how great the emperor is who made these Roman roads, right? So it's a very much a propaganda tool. You're driving along the road, you're not driving, you're on your donkey or you're walking. So you have plenty of time to notice all the signs. And as you go, every mile you're seeing emperor, Caesar, imperator, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know very well who's in charge. Okay. These roads are very useful for the Romans, obviously for their soldiers, also for trade. They're also useful for Jews. All right. Jews use them. It's good to travel. You need to get from place to place. You need to have an economy, but it's very much a double-edged sword, right? We have the very famous statement of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who he's sitting and Rabbi Yehuda starts and says, oh, those Romans, look what they built for us, markets and roads and bathhouses. Oh, so amazing. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, you think they built it for you? They didn't build it for you. They built it for themselves. All right. So it's a way to control, but it can also be very useful. So if you look at the map here, we've got some major roads, right? The red ones and you know, this map, other people might draw it differently, but certainly nobody would disagree that the two major, major roads here since biblical times, the Romans continue it, are what's called the Via Maris, right? The sea road going up the coast and then one branch continues up all the way towards Tyre and Sidon towards Lebanon. Another branch crosses the Jezreel Valley and goes up and all the way out to the east. So that's a major important road. The King's Highway, the other side of the Jordan, right? Traveling north-south. We have another major north-south road that goes through the ridge of the mountains, what we call the Path of the Patriarchs, Derech Ha'avot, but it's also a Roman road, okay? And then we have a lot of east-west roads, a very important one, which some people who've traveled around in Israel may have been on parts of it. That's what this road is the one that goes from Jerusalem past Beit Guvrin, which is an important Roman city, Eleutheropolis, and all the way out to the coast. So you have this really complicated network of roads. We have sources that talk about traveling on the road. We have a lot of sources that talk about traveling on the roads. And a lot of it is about the danger on the roads, right? The roads are dangerous, not because of traffic accidents, but because of bandits, of highwaymen. The Romans create a certain sense of peace, but not always. And we even have a statement from the third century, the time when there's Roman anarchy, where there's very little control, where we have Rabbi Yonah, who says, if you're going on a journey, you should first leave a get for your wife. Okay, so roads are not always as comforting as we would like them to be, but they were often very, very useful. This I put in just because it's neat. And some student decided to create a subway map of the Roman road network. Okay, it's based on the tube maps from London. Just for our purposes, it's nice to see. Well, first of all, obviously, we know that all roads lead to Rome, right? Here's Rome, and it's really at the center of the system. Okay, this guy also put here Elio Capitolina. Here's Jerusalem. He obviously did not put in all the roads in all the different places, but we do have our King's Highway going up here, right? We have our Via Maris going up here or across, right? So we do have, and we can also see from here, which is nice, how the land of Israel can connect with other places. We can continue and go all the way across to North Africa. You can go into Asia Minor. You can really go by land to quite a lot of places. Why don't we continue to Babylonia? Because the Roman Empire doesn't include Babylonia. How did they travel to Babylonia? That will save for next week. Okay, so it's just kind of neat. I really should have put the guy's name here. Oh, no, there he is. Sasha Trachberger or something. Some nice Jewish guy. Okay. So that's just to give us a little bit of an idea of Roman roads. But now let's get deeper into the different parts of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so Chazal like to talk about sections of Eretz Yisrael, okay, for various reasons. Okay, usually halacha, right? Why do we talk about things? We talk about them for halachic purposes, sometimes also for political purposes. But the basic division, we have two types of divisions. Okay? One is Yehuda and the Galil, Judea and the Galilee, and one is Judea, the Galilee, and Transjordan, Eivor HaYarden. Okay, Ze'ev Safrai writes about how the sources that talk about Eivor HaYarden, the Transjordan, are usually earlier, the Mishnaic sources as opposed to Gemara sources, because Jews are living in this place. It's a nice, strong Jewish community in the time of the Second Temple, but by the time we get to the Bar Kokhba revolt, Jews have pretty much left here, and it's not an important site anymore. Like I said, we'll come back to that. But let's talk about Judea and the Galilee. All right, so we have various sources here, and explains to us why do we need to divide this up, right? Who cares? Why is this important? All right, so here's where you can start looking at your source sheets. There are three territories in respect to the law of the removal of shvi produce. Okay, the word in Hebrew is much simpler. There are three territories for biur. What is biur? If you live in the land of Eretz Yisrael, if you live in the land of Israel and you have things that grew in the sabbatical year, right, in the Shnat HaShemitah, you're allowed to gather them in, you're allowed to eat them, but only until they stop growing in the fields. And at that point, you have to get them out of your house. You have to do biur, or you have to either eat them or put them out and make them hefker. We actually still do this in Eretz Yisrael. Usually it's connected to wine, Kedushat Shvi'it wine, that you have to get rid of after the time that that the grapes have been growing. But obviously, this is something that has to do with where things get ripe. The climate is different in the Judean desert than it is in the high mountains of the Galil. Okay? The pomegranates are all ripe in the Judean desert now. They are not ripe high in the mountains. So there are three territories. This is different in different places: Judea, Transjordan, and the Galilee. And there are, and each one is subdivided into three. We'll come to that in the next slide. Okay, I just wanted us to get kind of a bigger picture here. That's one ramification. When do things get ripe? When does fruit stop growing in the fields? Obviously, it depends on the climate and the topography. Here we have another one. This is a more sociological. Eretz Yisrael is divided into three separate lands with regard to marriage. Hey, what's going on here? So we're going to see in a minute that actually there are different marriage customs in Yehuda and in the Galil, but that's not what this Mishnah is talking about. This Mishnah is talking about if the husband is from the Galil and the wife is from Judea, and they get married and they decide they're going to live in Judea, he cannot coerce her to move to the Galio with him because she won't have her friends. She won't understand what's going on. She won't know how to do the shopping, right? And then the Gemara goes on, continues on and talks of the Mishnah also about leaving Eretz Yisrael. But that's what we're talking about here. It's a very sociological thing, right? So if you're in one region, you need to stay in that region unless you have the agreement of both couples, okay? Finally, we have something that how do we know the borders of these places? So you have a Mishnah, which is a complicated Mishnah. It's hard to understand. We're not going to go into the meaning of the Mishnah, but what we want to do is look at the definitions of Yudah and the Galil in the Mishnah. Okay, here we go. Mishnah Gittin. This is your bill of divorce, Hare Giter, if I do not come back from now until the conclusion of 30 days. And when he was going from Judea to the Galilee, he reached Antipatris and returned immediately. His condition is void. Okay, so he makes a condition. He makes a tnai. I'm going from Yudah to the Galilee. If he goes to Antipatris and comes back, his tnai doesn't work. Meaning Antipatris, whatever else the Mishnah means, Antipatris is the border of Yehuda. Okay, same thing if we go on with the Mishnah, okay, if he was going from the Galil to Yehuda and he reached Kfar Otnai and returned immediately, his condition is void. So we have a border for Yehuda, we have a border for the Galil. The border for Yehuda, Antipatris, okay, is more or less about here. Okay, this is very not correct, not exact, but it's a city that was built by Herod, Antipatris. It's actually built on the remains of a biblical town named Afek. It's actually on this very significant road, the sea road, and where the road kind of narrows and goes in. So it's a very strategic place. Everybody knew where it was, right? This is the border, more or less, of Yehuda. Okay, where's our border for the Galil? Kfar Otnai. Kfar Otnai is a term that doesn't sound so familiar to us. Right? The Romans had a different name for it. They called it Legio. Legio from the same word as legion. Okay, because this is where the 6th legion hung out. Okay, we call it today. It's right near the town of Megiddo. Okay? Megiddo in the Jezreel Valley. Okay. Megiddo is a fascinating place, biblical times, around for centuries and centuries and centuries. Then it's abandoned. And then this new place, Kfar Otnai, is built right nearby. Okay. But our border for the Galilee, as we're going to see, is basically the Jezreel Valley. Okay. So here's our Galilee. Here's our Yehuda, at least according to the Mishnah in Gittin. Okay. I'm seeing there's lots of things in the chat. I really hope I will make time at the end to answer, but have patience. Okay. This is what I was saying before. We have a subdivision, right? Each area is divided into 3 sub areas. So in the Galilee, we have the Upper Galilee. Don't worry, I'm going to show you a map in a minute. The Upper Galilee, the Lower Galilee, and the Valley. Okay, and even today we use those terms. You're learning about, the geography of the land of Israel. You talk about Galil Elyon, Galil Tachton. Today they changed the name because the people of Galil Tachton didn't like to be called the Lower Galilee. So they gave it a new name. I don't even know what it's called anymore. And the valley being the Jezreel Valley, Emek Yisrael. They each are different because they have a different climate and a different topography, right? The Upper Galilee, the hills are very stark, very tall, deep valleys. This picture over here on the right, this is a beautiful, beautiful area called the Keshet Cave, Ma'arat Keshet. It's all the way up near the border with Lebanon. This is the Upper Galilee. Very, very dramatic terrain, tall mountains, deep valleys. The Lower Galilee is much more kind of moderate, right? Same thing in Yehuda, in Judea, the mountain region, the plains, and the valley. The valley here really means the desert. Right? So we say the mountains, Hare Yehuda, the mountains of Judea, which I did not bring a picture of for you here. The plains, the Shvelah, that's what you have over here, like where Beit Shemesh is, the more moderate hills. And the desert, the valley, they wanted to make it, the Mishnah is trying to make it parallel, right? So we have valley in the Galilee, we have valley in Yehuda, and it is a valley, the area of the desert. We have the Jordan Valley, we have the deep area of the Dead Sea Rift. but it's really the Judean desert. So it's based on the climate and it's based on the topography. Now the climate and topography are different. Are the people also different? And that's a really interesting question. We have all kinds of statements all over Chazal. Chazal love to, I won't say Chazal. Chazal is not a fair term, right? There's many different types of people. We have lots of different statements where we say things that, let's just say, they wouldn't be so politically correct today, right? Famously, Babylonians are very stupid, right? Ani Bavli Tipshai, right? There's all kinds of stereotypes about all sorts of people. Here, we don't have stereotypes so much as observations. What did these people do? What were some of their customs? What was the, did they continue their learning, right? We do have stereotypes as well. And the question is, scholars, early scholars, Jewish and largely Christian, okay, looked at these statements and they took them very much at face value. And they said, oh, the people of Judah, the people of Judea, they are very scholarly. They are very learned. There's lots of rabbis there. They're very snobby. The people of the Galilee, oh, those are the simple people, right? Those are the people who are the fishermen and the farmers, and they have folk religion and they don't actually know any Torah. Part of this obviously connects to the history of Christianity, right? We talk about Jesus going and finding his followers around the Sea of Galilee, and they're fishermen and they're farmers and they believe in miracle workers, et cetera, et cetera. Today, we look at it a little bit more sophisticated. We have statements. We take the statements with a grain of salt, and we try to prove as much as possible. One of the things we can know, archaeology usually tells us more than statements will. So one of the things we are finding out from archaeology, and we'll talk about this more next time, is we have a statement here, the very first statement here in the Gemara in Erevin, about language. Okay, the people of Judea, who were precise in their language and who would formulate mnemonics for their studies, their Torah knowledge endured for them. With regard to the people of the Galilee who were not precise in their language and who would not formulate mnemonics, their Torah knowledge did not endure for them. What do they mean precise in their language? That they know Hebrew. Okay? They speak Hebrew. They speak Aramaic. They are more, it's different to read something in translation than to read it in the Makor, in the original. And when we do excavations of synagogues in the Galil, the inscriptions are almost always, not completely, but rarely, rarely, rarely in Hebrew. Okay? And even if it is in Hebrew, a lot of times it's written wrong. We actually have another statement in the Gemara that talks about mispronouncing things, that people in the Galil don't know how to pronounce their Hebrew. It's mostly written in Greek. Whereas in Judea, it's mostly Hebrew and Aramaic. So that is something that you can take to the bank, right? That's something that we have an actual, we have actual evidence. Then we have other statements here, right? Were the people of the Galilee more pious? Maybe, right? Here we say the rabbis say in Judea, people would perform labor on Passover Eve till midday, right? They would work on Erev Pesach. And in the Galilee, people would not perform labor on Passover Eve at all. Okay. Are they firmer in the Galilee? Maybe. Or maybe because they have to travel so far for the Korban Pesach to get to Jerusalem. If they did, they couldn't work. Right? We also have statements about, did they have mourning customs on Shabbat or not, right? We have different things like that. We also hear about the people of the Galil, and this is in two different types of sources, that they are very argumentative, they are very militant, they are very, honor is very important to them. Okay, so here if we hear from a different source, from Josephus. Okay, Josephus, our Jewish historian of the Great Revolt, and he says, these two Galilees of so great largeness and encompassed with so many nations of foreigners have been always able to make a strong resistance on all occasions of war. For the Galileans are inured to war from their infancy and have always been very numerous, nor has the country ever been destitute of men of courage or wanted a numerous set of them. Okay, so they're fighters. They're always fighting. They're always arguing. They're always going to war. Yes, in Josephus's time in the Great Revolt, we do have quite a few of the important rebel leaders come from the Galil. However, in the Bar Kokhba Revolt, we hear not so much. We know the people of the Galil took part in the Bar Kokhba revolt, but we don't have the leaders coming from there. The headquarters are not up there. So again, take it with a grain of salt. And here we have in Nedarim, right? Great source. Rabbi Yehuda says the people of Galilee were quarrelsome, kanteranin, and they would often take vows prohibiting benefit from one another. This is a great source, right? It's not talking about them going to war. It's saying, you get on my nerves. I'm Kona Malacha. You can't enjoy anything from me. You can never come eat lunch in my house. Like, you annoy me so much, right? So what did they do? Their forefathers rose and wrote their portions of the public property over to the Nasi so that they would be able to use communal property. They didn't want, you know, Joe Schmo from the town in the Galil to say, well, I have a part ownership in the Beit Knesset, and you made me so mad that I am not allowing you to use that part of the Beit Knesset. So instead, they would turn over all their property to the Nasi, and then it would belong to everybody. So that's a great statement. Again, is Rabbi Yehuda a little bit, I don't know, biased, maybe? Okay, here we get less opinions and more customs, okay? In customs, at least from the sources that we're going to see here, the people of the Galil were more conservative, more modest. You could say it in different ways, right? Rabbi Yehuda said, in Judea, at first they would seclude the groom and bride for a brief period before their entry into the wedding canopy so that he would grow accustomed to her. And in the Galil, they did not do so. Now, the discussion in the Gemara is not only that they had yichud. It's not only that they stayed together for a brief period. It seems that in Yehuda, I'm sure not everybody did this, but it was not uncommon for the bride and the groom to live together before they got married. And in the Galil, very not accepted, right? So is the Galil more conservative? Is the Galil more religious? I don't know, but that's one of the statements that we have here, okay? In the Galil, they also were more worried. And here it's not a subjective thing. They worried more about the widows. Okay? If somebody is widowed, she gets the money from her ketubah. She gets the money that her husband owes her from her marriage contract. But there's different ways to pay that out. And here in the Mishnah, it tells us different ways that this was done. If he did not write for her, you should live in my house and be maintained from my estate throughout the duration of your widowhood. He is nevertheless liable because this clause is a condition laid down by the court. Thus did the men of Jerusalem write, and the men of Galilee wrote as did the men of Jerusalem. What does this mean? This means the husband dies. The wife is in the house. She can stay there as long as she wants and get money, and she does not get paid off from her ketubah and sent out into the street. That's what they did in the Galil. The men of Yehuda used to write, until the heirs wish to pay you your ketubah. Therefore, if the heirs wish to, they may pay her ketubah and dismiss her. Goodbye. Here's your 200 manat, right? Here's your money out the door. I'm not supporting you anymore. So the people of the Galil were much more sympathetic to the widow than the people of Yehuda. One other thing, and this I think makes sense, right? The Mishnah Nedarim talks about, again, vows that you make. Do you know the terminology? Unspecified truma in Judea is forbidden. In the Galilee is permitted, as the people of the Galilee are unfamiliar with the collection of the chamber, truma talishka. Again, we don't need to go into the details, but the people of the Galil don't know as much about how things work for Kohanim, for the Beit HaMikdash. That makes sense. They're far away. Right? They're just not as aware how things work. So, you know, do we really have an idea? Not so much. But again, archaeology a little bit. When we uncover the synagogues in the Galil and in Yehuda up until now, we found that there are many more synagogues, not all, but many more synagogues in the Galil that have imagery, that have pictures of the zodiac, that have pictures of scenes from the Tanakh, right? Whereas in Yehuda, much less, right? Much less. You'll have inscriptions, you won't have images, or you'll have geometric designs. Again, this is something that we're uncovering more and more, but that's also an interesting idea. In the Galil, did they pay less attention to what the rabbis had to say about images? Maybe. Right? The picture that I brought you here is of the cliffs of the Arbel, which is a place where Galilean rebels fought against Herod. And this is before the Great Revolt. So it gives us a little bit of a feeling of their of their militancy. Another section, I mentioned this briefly when we were looking at the map, is the Darom. Okay, Darom means south. The rabbis mentioned the Darom, Daroma. It can mean anything from Lud and Bnei Brak, which is not far from Tel Aviv of today, down to Beersheba. It's a very broad term. And it means the places that are not the Galil. Okay? But we do have a very interesting subsect. Well, first of all, before that, we have very few sages that come not from Lud and Bnei Brak, but from further south. The most famous one is Rabbi Yishmael, who comes from a place called Kfar Aziz, which is in the south of Hebron. And that brings us to this very interesting kind of sub-community in the Darom, in the real south, what's called the southern Hebron Hills, right? Drom Har Hebron. We have very little sources about it, but here's where we have archaeology, okay? And there's a set of communities south of Hebron, okay, meaning south of Jerusalem, south of Beit Lechem, south of Hebron, going all the way in the direction of Beersheba, not all the way down there, okay, where we found Jewish communities that go back to Second Temple times and continue into the time of the Amoraim, okay, Maon, Shamoa. This is pictures from Susia, which has been the most extensively excavated and which is the only one of those that you can really go visit today. And they're very interesting, because they have a certain theme that you see a lot of. You see a lot of mikvaot, even in the layers that are quite a few hundred years after the destruction of the Second Temple. You see a lot of imagery of menorahs. You see the synagogues. This picture on the right here is a synagogue, in Susia. The synagogue is oriented that you enter from the east and you go towards the west. Okay? A lot of things that are similar to the Beit HaMikdash, okay? And to purity and being emphasizing purity. And one suggestion of scholars who have excavated here is that this community is Kohanim, okay? Priests, who when everybody leaves Judea because of the Bar Kokhba revolt and the destruction, and they go to the Galil, these guys say, no, the Beit HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt soon. We don't want to go too far. We want to stay close by. And so they build themselves communities that recall the Beit HaMikdash. They continue to eat food in purity for hundreds of years after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, and they wait for it to be rebuilt. So that's also a fascinating community. Okay, we'll do quickly just one other Jewish area, and then we'll go to some of the non-Jews. Right, so the Golan, like I said, not mentioned too much in rabbinic sources, but in archaeology, right, if you look, this is the Golan, and all the things you're seeing here, all the names, these are all places that synagogues were discovered. And this map is, I think, at least 10, maybe 20 years old. There have been many more that have been discovered. So you can see there's a huge concentration of synagogues in the Galil and the Golan. And the Golan has quite a nice number of them, right? Quite a lot of synagogues that are here. You don't have big cities, right? You don't have major population centers. The Jews are living in the south and the central Golan, not in the north. The north is more non-Jews, okay? And they're living mostly in small towns and villages, okay, doing rather nicely for themselves. They're making enough money that they can build really beautiful synagogues. And that's the main building of the town. They don't have a lot of other important public buildings. Okay? And it's very interesting because here they are. They're kind of off of the radar screen, not only of Chazal, but of the Romans as well. Nobody really bothers them. They do their own thing. They're living in their communities. And so they're being able to build these really beautiful synagogues. Just to give us a few names, what you see here on the right is in the rebuilt synagogue in Katsrin, which today is a thriving, is the only town, the only Jewish town in the Golan. We also have Deir Aziz, we have Ein Nashut, we have Omal Kanatir, we have Kanaf, we have lots and lots of places. And we are discovering the synagogues that are there. Here we have a picture of the reconstructed synagogue in Omal Kanatir, which is a really fabulous place where there was an earthquake, and it was such an isolated place that basically most of the stones were not moved anywhere else. And when the archaeologists came along and started to excavate, they were able to rebuild the synagogue from the stones that existed there already. You could see this very beautiful, what's called a heichalit, a place where they kept the Torah, and it has stairs going up to it. Very elaborate, very, very beautiful. The other thing, a great discovery that was found in the Golan in a site called Daburiya. Now, this was a Jewish town, and I don't know if you can see it. It's a little hard to see, but it has an inscription, and it says, Zehu Beit Midrasho Shel Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar. We hear about him. He is a well-known figure, one of the last of the Tanaim. His son, we think, is Bar Kapra. And this is his Beit Midrash, right? We don't usually find things that say this is the Beit Midrash. We don't hear about Batei Midrash as a physical place. So that's a really cool thing to find. Okay, let's talk for a few minutes about non-Jews, okay? The Shomronim. We mentioned them briefly before, right? The Shomronim. We will not go into the whole story of their origins. Just suffice it to say that in the Book of Kings, the Assyrians come. They exile the 10 tribes from Shomron and the whole area of the Northern Kingdom. They bring in other peoples. According to Tanakh, these people are attacked by lions. Because they don't know how to follow the customs of land. And they petition the Assyrians. They say, bring us a Kohen to teach us Mishpat Elokei Haaretz. We want to know how to serve God. And then they become Jews, sort of. The Shomronim, by the way, do not say this. They say they are the true Jews and everybody else got it wrong. But in the time, in the way Chazal tell it, they call the Shomronim Kutim. Because we know it says they come from a place called Kuta, and they are really very interesting. We have a lot of conflicts with the Shomronim. On the other hand, the rabbis are always like, they're always in this middle place. Are they Jews? Are they not Jews? Do we trust their shechita? Do they do Brit Milah? Are we able to like trust their women's Taharat HaMishpacha? We have really a very, very interesting statement in one of the small, tiny little Masechtot, the Masechet Ktana of the Masechet Kutim, which says everything the Kutim did, they do even better than Yisrael. Right? It's fascinating, right? They keep the, and if you go today, you can still go to the tiny Shomroni community on Har Gerizim, and they'll explain to you their halacha, and they're very, very, very strict about, Taharat HaMishpacha. They're very, very strict about Yom Kippur. A baby that is weaned from his mother fasts on Yom Kippur. Certain things they are very, very, very careful about. However, they had great conflicts with us when they're very powerful in Second Temple times and afterwards. They disrupt the Masuot, the Rosh Chodesh lighting. Right? We have a lot of interesting hostile conflicts with them. And that's why a lot of people who traveled from the Galil to Yerushalayim chose to circumvent Samaria. They didn't want to go through the land of the Shomronim. Chazal even talk about it as being it's a place of Tum'ah. And so they go around by the Transjordan. Okay, so what do we have in the pictures here? We have this is the buildings that are on Har Gerizim, which is the place that is holy to them. Chazal say that we will accept them back to be Jews once they renounce Har Gerizim and they accept Har Habayit. Okay, so this is a very significant tenet for them and for us. However, they have synagogues, right? We have lots of Samaritan synagogues around Eretz Yisrael. We might come back to the Samaritans later, but for now, let's talk a little about pagans, okay? We mentioned that the cities on the coast, as well as some of the cities in the valley, in the Jezreel Valley, the Jordan Valley, are polises, are Roman cities, start out as Greek, become Roman. There are Jews living in these places. However, they're not always so comfortable in these places, right? You could see this great picture on the right here of the theater in Beit She'an, right? Caesarea, of course, also has a theater. The picture on the left is from Ashkelon, where you can see the statues, the pagan statues that were in the center of the town. So Jews are living here, but in a way that's sort of like Jews living in the diaspora. They have to live under as a minority among the majority of non-Jews who start out as pagans, eventually Christians, and they have to worry about anti-Semitism, and they have to worry about idolatry, and they have to worry about what stores they can shop in and when, because maybe the store gives a percentage of their income to Avodah Zarah. Right, the Gemara talks about chanuyot meutarot, like they're decorated. They have a little sign in their window, right? 10% of today's income is going to St. Mary's Church, right? That's the idea. Are you allowed to patronize a store like that? So we have these cities that are very important cities, but Jews are the minority as opposed to Jerusalem or even a place like Tveria, which obviously has non-Jews as well, but it has a much more of a Jewish character to it. Okay, we're not going to get to everything today, I already can see, but let's at least try to talk a little about Jerusalem. Now, by the time we get to the Mishnah and certainly the Gemara, Jerusalem is empty of Jews. Okay, the Mikdash has been destroyed in the year 70. Jews still seem to be living there with the Bar Kokhba revolt in the 130s. Jerusalem is turned by the Romans into Aelia Capitolina. Jews are forbidden to come there. And Jerusalem becomes what we call Yerushalayim Shalmala, right? Heavenly Jerusalem. Now, we still have lots of testimony in the Mishnayot about what things were like. We have a generation, two generations that remember the Beit HaMikdash. Eh? But even those people who remember, so for example, the Masechet that talks the most about the structure of the Mikdash is Masechet Midot. And in Masechet Midot, one of the stars of the Masechet is somebody called Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. And even Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, when he's telling how things were and what they look like and telling eyewitness testimonies, even he says, in two occasions in Masechet Midot, I forgot what was there. I forgot what they used this for, right? Because by the time you're gathering this testimony, the Mikdash has been destroyed. So that's a complicated thing. On the other hand, it's very, very important to Chazal to always be relating back to Jerusalem, even when we're not in Jerusalem. And if you look at very basic things, right? If you look at the beginnings of some of quite a few of the Masechtot, right? Think about the very, very first Mishnah, the first Mishnah in Shas, Ematai Korim Kriyat Shema, right? When the Kohanim come in from the Mishmarot, right? What, really? That's, you don't say when the sun goes down, when you finish eating dinner. What are you going back to the Kohanim? What's the connection? Because we want to be connecting to the Beit HaMikdash. Shabbos. What's Shabbos? The Lamed Tet Melacho that we made the Mishkan. Hey, what's Sukkah? How tall is too tall for a Sukkah? The height of the entrance into the Heichal. We always want to be coming back to those ideas. Okay, so here we have just a little bit to jog our memory of the Ezrat Nashim, of the different Lishakhot, the different chambers all around, oriented, right? You enter from the east. As you go more west, you get more holy. The Azara, the Kodesh Kodashim, right? We're always coming back to there. A few things that are connected to Jerusalem, and then I think we'll save the rest for next time. I had a feeling this would happen. One of the Masechet Yoma is a fascinating Masechet because it has a lot of eyewitness or maybe pseudo eyewitness, but it's told as eyewitness accounts of how the avoda was done in the Beit HaMikdash, right? The majority of the Masechet is about that day of what the Kohen Gadol does and how he does it. And one of the parts of the story is the two goats, right? The Goral, the Seir LaHashem, the Seir LaZazel. Seir LaZazel, where is it sent from? Where does it go? So it has to go from Har HaBayit out to Har HaZeitim and out towards the desert, okay? Now, where exactly? We talk about Har HaZazel. It doesn't have to be a specific place. It has to be the desert. It happens to be that it seems there was a specific place in much of Bayit Sheni times, but it doesn't have to be. It has to be the desert because the desert is the contrast to the settled land. The desert is Zachartila Chesed Nuraich, right? Hashem remembers our days in the desert. The desert is a place that's hefker that you can connect to Torah. Right? A lot of different ideas connected to the desert. How did it get out there? So the Mishnah in Yoma talks about a ramp that was built from Har HaBayit to Har HaZeitim, right, to go across. And again, making fun of the Alexandrians and the Babylonians, who are like hitting the goat and say, take our sins, get out of here. Do we have such a ramp? Have we found any remains of it? So far, no, right? There's no remains found in Nahal Kidron of such a ramp. But that's not so crazy, because that's not the sort of thing that would last very long. It's a bridge is hard, right? And one earthquake and your bridge is gone. There's no reason to doubt the Mishnah that there was something that was constructed, whether temporary or permanent, to take the goat out towards the desert. Another fascinating element, both of Yom Kippur and also other times, is where did they prepare the Para Aduma, right? And where did they have what's called the Beit HaSrefa? The Beit HaSrefa is where you take parts of the Korban, the sacrifice, that are not put on the altar, right? And you have to burn them. And the Gemara talks about that you have to burn them outside of the city. And we have two opinions, right? Rabbi Elazar says you burn them in the east in the same place as the Para Aduma. And the Rabbana and the Chachamim say you burn them in the north, outside of the city to the north, as opposed to outside of the city to the east. So we have two possibilities, right? The east is actually, if you go on Har HaZeitim, about halfway down on Har HaZeitim, is this impressive looking church called Dominus Flevit. If you go into the courtyard of the church, you have the most spectacular view, eye contact, looking directly onto Har HaBayit. And we are pretty sure that this is the place of the Para Aduma, and this is the place of the Beit HaSrefa, if it's in the east. It's the most logical place. You have to have eye contact for the Para Aduma with the Beit HaMikdash. And that's why Chazal talk about the eastern gate, Shar Shushan, is lower, so that you can actually see into the Mikdash itself. Could it be that it's in the north, this Beit HaSrefa? Perhaps, right? And that's where we talk about going outside the city, right? At the end of Second Temple times, the city expands far beyond the wall of the old city today. This is called the Third Wall. Today it's in the area across the street from Mea Shearim, okay? And that seems to be what Chazal mean when they say in the north. We have memory from the 19th century. A scholar, an academic, wrote about how there's a pile of ashes out here near the remains of the Third Wall, which is fascinating, right? It's not there anymore because it's all been built up. Could it be that these are ashes that are remained still from the ashes of these parts of the Korbanot that were burnt up outside the city? Very interesting. We don't know. Okay. I'm just going to finish up this last one because it's also Yerushalayim, and then we'll go to questions. I'm going to steal 5 minutes, if that's okay, Rabbi Kalman. Beit Pagi. Okay. Beit Pagi is one of these strange places that the Gemara sort of knows what it is, sort of doesn't know where it is, or actually knows where it is in two different places. Okay, so we won't go into all the details here, but basically we have a bunch of references to a place called Beit Pagi. Some of them seem to show that it's right near the Temple Mount, and others seem to say, well, it's near Jerusalem, but it's kind of on the outskirts of Jerusalem, right? It's on the walls. It's by a field where you could thresh. No, it's right near Beit HaMikdash, so you could bring your Korban Pesach there. No, it's outside the walls, and so the bread is not sanctified there, right? All these different references, it seems very confusing. Add to the confusion the New Testament, where Jesus is coming into Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, and he gets to a place called Bethpage, Beit Pagi, same thing, okay? And today there's still a village there. What's going on? Is it close? Is it far? So one suggestion by Ben Sion Segal, the geographer of the Mishnah, says there's two. That's always a good answer, right? There's one that's right by Har HaBayit. It's either to the north or to the east. And we know there's a village right outside of Shaar Rachamim. We have some remains of it. And then there's what's called the village of Beit Pagi, the Kfar Beit Pagi. And that's all the way on the other side of Har HaZeitim. But I'll just add two more things, which I think are fascinating. Hey, Rashi, hey, when he talks about, we hear about, in Baba Metzia 9, right, this on the source on the bottom here, I brought it in Hebrew because it doesn't make sense in English for us. Amar Rav Ashi, ze kana chamor ubeit pageha. When you buy a donkey, what's included? The halter. Take a look at this nice donkey with the halter, right? Rashi says, why is Beit Pagi called Beit Pagi? Because it encircles the city like a donkey's halter encircles its head. Very nice. The other thing that's very nice, what are pagim? Hey, if you go to Israel to a hospital, what's the neonatal ward? The preemies? Preemies are pagim. They're baby figs. That's what a pag is. Hateina chanta pagea. And in this chapter in the New Testament, it talks about a donkey and about figs. So they seem to be playing with this word and with this idea. Okay. We are going to leave the other things for a different part of the series. Rabbi Kalman, we might end up doing six and not five. Who knows? Let's take a look at the questions. All right. Hold on. Okay. Susa's areas we answered. Several Babylonian Tanaim. Yes, but we don't, they're not part of this chain of tradition that we call, you know, that we talk about when we talk about first generation, second generation. And we're going to talk next time about going back and forth as well as the community in Babylonia. So I'm going to leave that. I don't know what QEW means, so I'm not going to even say that. Okay.
Queen Elizabeth Way.
What?
Queen Elizabeth Way, that's the highway they built when Queen Elizabeth first came.
Oh, the King's Highway, okay.
Canada. You're talking about the King's Road. I'm sorry, I put that in.
Got it, got
Canadians
it.
Canadians know what it is. Yeah, I'm surprised you don't know.
Hey, you don't, I don't know the abbreviations. Yeah. Okay, the researchers, I will put it in writing in the chat when I finish going through here if you want to stick around, or I can bring it next time, maybe. Is there a relationship between the Roman Maal Chazal's meal? Much ink has been spilled on this. There are articles about it. Rav Yoel Elitzur writes about it, and I am not going to go into it here. I will suffice it to say that more or less it's the same. Let's just put it that way. But it's complicated. Roman miles are not like U.S. miles or like kilometers. They're in between. Okay. Roman miles, 5,000 feet. Maps that are printable. Yeah, it's all copyright issues, but most of what I take is from Wikipedia, but, you know, play around, look on the internet. Golanitis is connected to Golan, exactly, not Gaul. The video is partially frozen. I hope that's not true. Okay, the Gemara about the Babylonians being stupid, by the way, is not only about standing for a Sefer Torah. They also talk about how they eat nama binama. They eat bread mixed with bread. What, you made a bread sandwich? What's the matter with you Babylonians? Right? We hear about this. There are all kinds of put downs all over. All right. Nikudot. No, mnemonics are like ways of remembering things. Okay, I'm not going to go into the practice of kicking out the widow, but I agree with you. It is terrible. And women had a hard time in the old days. Beit Alpha is not close to Jerusalem. Beit Alpha is in the Jezreel Valley. The Jews are kicked out of Jerusalem by Hadrian, and a lot of their villages are destroyed. But in the Darom, in the far south, it seems nobody bothered, right? Nobody came down to get them. We have Mikvaot in the Golan, definitely, okay? I have no idea about genetics on the Samaritans. Probably somebody did do that. And Okef Chawara road was built, so you can go visit the Shomronim and be Okef Chawara. Jews avoiding Samaria. A mnemonic is called a siman. Yes, thank you. That's helpful. A ramp built for the Paraduma. All right. Keep in Agabe, keep in. Yes, but look, what can I tell you? We have not found any remains of it. It's an interesting point. I think it makes sense that we're talking about things that fall down into the valley with an earthquake. It's in the valley, flash flood, washed away, not a crazy thing. It is a prison, not a person. If the person is located in the prison, look up the source and you'll understand it better. We scheduled me for six. Okay, maybe seven. Yerushalayim Shalmala means heavenly Jerusalem, right? We talk about it. It's a phrase that's used in the Midrash. And basically it means the Jerusalem of the imagination, I think is a good way to translate it. I don't know if I could come up with a better way. Yerushalayim Shalmata is what we live in every day, and we drive in and we say, wow, there's so much traffic here. Yerushalayim Shalmala is this, wow, heavenly Jerusalem, everything when Mashiach is going to come. Really, the way it's used in the Midrash is that God makes a Yerushalayim Shalmala. He makes a temple in the heavens that eventually is going to come down to earth, okay, when Mashiach comes. But it's used more in the sense of like, yeah, I think an imaginary Jerusalem, something like that. I don't know if Rabbi Kalman, if you have a better translation for that. But that is it. We got to the end of the questions. Okay, time for your announcements.
Maybe you call it the ideal Jerusalem.
Ideal. Maybe that's a better one.
I don't know, but thank you. Thank you. Okay, announcements. Tonight, of course, our Parsha Shir 8:30, Frenchie Yitzchak Berger. Tomorrow, my Siddur Shir 9:15. Of course, next week, of course, is our Tisha B'Av program. It's generally the biggest program of the year. If you haven't registered yet, please do so. And that will be 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern. I did get a complaint, Shuli, from somebody in Israel. Oh, you know, the fast is going to be over most of the classes. I said, okay, what can you do? But
enough going on here. I don't think you have to worry.
Yeah, exactly. Whether 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And like I say, if you come for all 8 hours, we give you a gift certificate to buy supper to break your fast or use some other time. If you can come for 8 hours. And Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag and Benny Gesundheit will be giving their regular classes. So we look forward to seeing you. As always, invite your friends. I know I've missed a lot of classes the last month. I've been, you know, traveling on our trips. I don't know if you saw the articles and stuff, but it's nice to be back. It's nice to go away. Nice to come home. And everybody be well. We should hear B'sarot Tovot and Shuli, keep up the humor.
Amen, if we can. Amen, so, amen. Thank you.
Okay, everybody be well. We look forward to seeing you very soon. Okay. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Shuli.
Tada rabba.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Okay.